It's the Polar Vortex edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Polar Vortex and Climate Change, Brain Dead Pregnancy, Fukushima Fears, and Fossil Fuels or Nuclear Energy. Which is the bigger killer? Let's begin episode 240.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. It is me, Don, your political scientist and skeptical philosopher. Now, as many of our listeners must have noticed, climate change is a hoax. If you stepped outside at least once last week, you experienced temperatures that rival those found on frozen Mars.
No, it wasn't really that bad here in Vancouver. What are you talking about?
Well, it's true. Here, it was okay, but if you lived anywhere east of Alberta, you experienced the same temperatures found on Mars. What? No. But it's cool if you think about it, that Mars during the summer is roughly the same temperature as our winters. In fact, it can get up to 70 degrees Fahrenheit or 20 degrees Celsius. Not a bad day here in Vancouver. Actually, the average temperature of Mars is about minus 50 degrees Celsius, which is very cold for my birthplace if you factor in wind chill factors. It's not really that unheard of. That although it's millions of miles further from the sun and a completely different planet, there is still overlap. Now, don't get me wrong, it gets a lot colder in Mars, but the average, and it's closer than you think. So if the interruptions are over, this cold weather must prove that climate change is wrong. So it's not proof. Let me look that up.
Let's do something a little more fun. How about combat training?
Find me. I'm going to learn. Find me.
Mikey, I think he likes it. How about some more?
Hell yes. I know climate.
Show me.
I now know climate change. So it seems that events such as these may actually support climate change, not a single event. Weather is random, but the frequency and average severity of climate events are predicted to increase as more energy is pumped into the atmosphere, i.e. global warming. So what causes cold snap? Well, to understand that, we must first understand the jet stream. Well, the polar jet stream. This is a band of fast-moving air, or maybe river of air is a better analogy, that races around the planet between the northern temperate zone and the polar zone. The zones are relatively stable air masses compared to the stream. As fall becomes winter and winter gets cold, the air at the polar zone gets colder and colder. Nothing new there. However, the polar jet stream, like a river, will meander up and down. Think of a winding river viewed from a plane. Now with the river, the windiness is determined by the power of the river. This does have an analogy in the jet stream, but a greater influence is what climatologists call temperature gradient. Cold polar air is denser and heavier than warm air. This means the amount of waviness of the jet stream is limited by the resistance it experiences to the difference in temperatures between the zones. However, as global warming rises, relative temperatures in the Arctic increases energy into the stream itself, the loops formed become more and more pronounced. That is, the cold loops, usually only sweeping south a little, and warm loops north a little, As climate change becomes more pronounced, the loops become more and more exaggerated to the point where the loops can cut itself off in the deep south. And by cut itself off, think of an eddy in a river. It's now a circular rotating ball of super cold. Because as earlier mentioned, cold air is heavier and warmer. It smashes its way deeper and deeper into the northern zone. Well, in this case, the southern area of the northern zone. Thus you get New Orleans issuing wind chill warnings, people in Atlanta freezing to death, and well, fecking cold weather. It should be noted that although the East Coast was blasted with cold weather, Alaska experienced a kind of heat wave. Well, for the middle of winter. Some of the more interesting things that rode the internet, there have been a lot of people who've been admitted to emergency departments because they saw a YouTube video, actually, now that I think about it, I think it was actually a news article, where they threw a pot of boiling water into the air and it instantly turns to snow at these super cold temperatures. It seems temperature is not the only factor in making the snow. Unfortunately, when some of the viewers decided to test the theory, they ended up getting scalding burns on their skin. I can only imagine how they boiled their skin to make snow. In fact, I don't have to imagine. Having done a little research, a number of them accidentally threw their pot of boiling water into the wind, which promptly threw it back onto the body. In fact, I heard one humorous story, and humorous in quotes here, where the person who attempted this experiment lived in Florida. Florida is one of the two states in the United States that did not go below the freezing point. The other one besides Florida was Hawaii. Americans, I worry about you sometimes. Adding hype to the temperature claims, much ado had been made by the fact that the Chicago Zoo kept its polar bear indoor because it was so cold. Even polar creatures would freeze. Well, not really. It seems that as polar bears live, quote, way south, as in they live in Chicago, well, this polar bear seems that there is only the one and that it had very little insulative fat. Something not needed for a southern polar bear, but something a polar bear in the wild would have had. So it's not that it was too cold even for polar bears. Wild polar bears with their fat would have been quite okay. That said, I'm not going to be a hypocrite. This was a weather event. They happen randomly. So this no more proves climate change than the nihilists say it disproves it. That said, after the fourth one of these this year, then maybe I might have to get on my high horse. We will return after this break.
Today in the news.
And today in the news.
Today in the news.
Tired of the same few voices giving you the same point of view on the news? You're not alone. The Campaign for Democratic Media is a nonpartisan, nonprofit group fighting to ensure that our public airwaves represent more than just one voice. Canadians deserve diverse, accountable, and quality Canadian media. Visit democraticmedia.ca to learn how you can stand up for media issues.
Hello, and welcome back. I heard a sad, but ethically and philosophically interesting story the other day. It seems that a mother-to-be, a Marlies Monzo, suffered a major stroke that has left her brain dead. The hospital has refused to turn off the life support, even after urging from the woman's spouse and parents, who stated that she explicitly stated she did not want to remain on prolonged life support if she was ever to be found in the state that she is now in, i.e. brain dead, with no hope of recovery. The reason the hospital gives for not turning off the life support is a Texas law that prevents them from doing so if the person in question is pregnant. At the time of her stroke, Marlies was 14 weeks pregnant. She is now 19 weeks pregnant. It is legal, if almost impossible, to get an abortion in Texas prior to 24 weeks. But is this an abortion? The now single father of a 15-month-old seems to see it that way. I will not try and get into the mind of the bereaved spouse, but because he is pursuing legal actions, his conviction that his life would be better and that honoring what he sees as a departed wife's wish to be primary, well, I trust he is doing what he sees is right. I am a strong supporter of women's choice. Thanks to global population, I would even say that I'm pro-abortion. That said, I would think it wrong if anyone other than the woman were to make that choice. It seems obvious that Marlies is incapable of giving consent. So calling this an abortion somehow seems wrong. One could make the analogy to a mentally challenged person who may have an abortion forced upon them by a guardian. But from what I can find out, a guardian may prevent an abortion, but not authorize one. So again, it seems unclear at best that can the spouse make the decision to perform an abortion on his brain-dead wife? That said, I've often argued that until a certain magical point, a fetus is just sort of a tumor, not a person at all, and thus the woman's right takes precedence. But in this case, well, she is for all intents and purposes dead. Dead people have no rights. So does this mean that the tumor, that it's living, and thus it now takes ethical precedence? Well, maybe. Now comes sort of a cost-benefit argument. Yes, life is theoretically priceless, but for those, especially in the United States, who cannot afford medication, operations, or treatments, and are left to die, well, could these resources be better used? That said, this leads to the opposite problem. What if the hospital wanted to turn off life support? How much money should the hospital spend? Money that could be used to save other patients. How many resources should be expended to, quote, save this one possible life? What if the father insisted? The reality of the situation is that the likelihood this potential life will be born healthy, or born at all, is pretty slim. At the end of the day, there's a greater possibility of a stillbirth or a child with severe birth defects. From the research I did, and this is based on cases where the mother was within a month or so of viability. Oh, sorry. Most physicians hold that at least 24 weeks is the earliest that a fetus can be deemed a baby, i.e. can be removed from the mother and kept alive. The cases I checked out used a 25-week marker. So it's not that simple. There is a parallel case in England where a brain-dead woman, 15 weeks pregnant, gave birth to a healthy child at 27 weeks. That said, another woman in 2005 was kept viable. It seems wrong to say alive when all that was really kept alive is sort of a uterus. But anyhow, the child died 5 weeks later. It's an ethically tough question. Less obvious as a regular abortion case or even a euthanasia plea. Ultimately, in my humble opinion, there are three things that sort of should be given weight. What is the likelihood of delivering a healthy child? If the odds are greater than, 60%, then it seems likely that keeping it alive takes precedence. Secondly, will the resources used to keep them alive likely cause the death of another? If keeping one person alive, mother or fetus, results in the death of two or more others, well, then pulling the plug seems prudent. And thirdly, how much anguish will it cause the survivors? If the other questions seem unanswerable or a toss-up, one should take into consideration the surviving spouse may not have the resources to take care of a potential child, especially if it may likely be a special needs child, or that the idea to them that their loved one is being tortured by remaining on life support. Then, again, pulling the plug seems appropriate. Conversely, if the survivor sees this as the one last way to keep a part of their spouse alive, to turn tragedy into a future, then keeping her alive seems valid. What are your thoughts? Email us at radiofreethinker.com. When we come back from break, Fukushima, just over 1,000 days ago. Should we be afraid?
Science is the best tool ever devised for understanding
the world. To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
A little over 1,000 days ago, the world suddenly and alarmingly became aware of a minor power plant located at Fukushima, Japan. In the wake of a double natural punch by a magnitude 9 earthquake, followed by a greater than 40-foot earthquake, the power at this plant was knocked out. Being a nuclear power plant, this was a big deal. The world watched in shocked silence as the next few days saw emergency crews pouring millions of gallons of ocean water on the nuclear cores of four reactors in an attempt to prevent a meltdown. As we now know, the efforts may have minimized the disaster, but a disaster it was. To refresh people's memories, there are several separate events that made this a disaster. The first was, as the cores boiled away the insulative and cooling water, much of that water was degraded into oxygen and hydrogen via thermolysis. At a certain point, three of the buildings had sufficient buildup of hydrogen that explosions were triggered, damaging the buildings. These are the explosion videos you see at YouTube at all. Now, these were not the cores exploding. At this point, the containment vessels for the nuclear reactors were intact, but some were suspected to have been damaged, like the building itself, by these explosions. Relatively speaking, little radiation was emitted from this, and these were sort of short-lived events. The next event, as the cores were heating up and attempts to repair and cool the reactors are failing, there were what are called spontaneous nuclear fission. I admit, when I first read this, my first thought was Hiroshima. But from what I've come to understand, these events, although technically fission, do not go boom. They do, however, and while it is suspected that the three of the reactors had a short period of experiencing spontaneous criticality, produce increased and specific nuclear radiation and radioactive components. That said, we cannot be sure any of the reactors actually achieved spontaneous criticality, well, at least for a few decades until we can actually get in there and take a really good look. The next event was what made famous in the 70s as the China Syndrome, was a partial core meltdown. It was called the China Syndrome because it occurred in New York, and it was believed when meltdown occurred, it would burrow its way through the earth to China. As you can guess, that actually means that when the temperature of the core is sufficient to melt the nuclear fusion. Now, when this happens, it's possible... Before I go on. I should explain how, in simple terms, as these are the only terms that I can understand, in simple terms, how a nuclear reactor is constructed. First, there are the fuel rods, the nuclear part of the plant. Then there are control rods that go between the fuel rods to speed up or slow down the fusion. These are housed, along with a frontline coolant, in the RPV, or reaction pressure vessel, usually made of a steel alloy. Then there is, quote, a drywall, a steel-walled container holding the RPV. This is itself within a containment vessel, usually reinforced concrete. So in the case of meltdown, it is believed that molten fuel breached the RPV and maybe even the drywall, but at its worst, only about 70 centimeters of a 7.5 meter concrete floor was, quote, dissolved in the worst case meltdown event. So even in the worst case scenario, none of the fuel escaped the building. That said, the last of the disaster was the water. In their efforts to cool the reactor, TEPCO, the private corporation who owns the reactor and was given sole responsibility for containing it, resorted to pouring millions of gallons of water both into the reactors and onto the storage fuel cells to keep temperatures under control. Unfortunately, most, if not all, of this water, now laden with radioactive iodine, cesium, strontium, and other radioactive byproducts, was washed into the ocean. Of all the health risks at Fukushima created, this is the most credible. But let's keep things in focus. The half-life, or the time it takes for half the quantity of radioactive material to essentially be not radioactive, the half-life of iodine-131 is 8 days. Cesium-137 is 30 years. Strontium-90, 30 years. And Trillium-129M, only 33 days. For those who live around Fukushima, these numbers are important. Because of the long-lasting ones are heavy, they are less likely to travel far from the power plant and thus pose little danger to the rest of the world. That is, by the time they actually end up on our shores, however many decades from now, they will pose little to no risk. Now, the main focus of this segment is to show how alarmists and fearmongers have exaggerated the real risk of Fukushima event. But I must point out, for those who lived around the plant, for those brave souls who worked at the plant, this was a disaster. There are real and present risks to working there, to living near there. I also wanted to make it clear that I think the way the private corporation with government acquiescence completely botched the cleanup effort. By putting profit ahead of public safety, locals are much more likely to suffer lingering effects. If only the government lived up to its duty to protect society and took charge from day one, much of the valid criticism would not exist. That said, if you live around Fukushima, get mad, get active. As for the rest of us, get real. Now, this is an attempt to be a double knockout. First, that the fearmongers over the, quote, atomic apocalypse done by Fukushima is bunk at best and exaggerated at worst. And secondly, relative to fossil fuel power plants, nuclear is a dream. It's like comparing car deaths, fossil fuels, to airline crashes, nuclear. If you had your choice, you would take a plane to work if you could. So lately, there's been some press about a report by some, quote, scientists that claim there's been a dramatic increase in child mortality that correlates, important word correlates, with the Fukushima accident. The report claims an increase of 35% in infant deaths following the disaster. It is implied that these deaths are a result of radioactive fallout on the West Coast. Run for the hills! However, if you check out the source of the data, the CDC or Center for Disease Control, some curious facts come to light. First, they only look at eight cities, Seattle, Portland, Boise, the one in Idaho, long way from the coast, San Francisco, Sacramento, Berkeley, San Jose, and Santa Cruz. Now these are large cities, but why include Boise? Why not the equally large Tacoma or Spokane, much closer to the coast and thus more likely to experience the effect of this, quote, radiation poisoning? So here we have our first hint of cherry picking of the data to conform to sort of a pre-concluded result. Next, if you look at the period of study, 4 weeks prior, 10 weeks post-accident. From this sample, you do see dramatic results. However, if you pull out to 10 weeks prior and 10 weeks after, you see no significant trend at all. Another report coming out lately is a lawsuit by a number of sailors on the aircraft carrier Ronald Reagan that helped with the emergency right after the natural disaster. 70 plus or so are claiming fallout has caused their health issues. One example used to show it must be Fukushima is that 20 are claiming testicular cancer out of a crew of 5,500. Now, national rates of cancer is 1 in 20,000. It does seem high, but correlation and causation are not the same thing. If radiation is the cause, one might point out that the Ronald Reagan is a nuclear-powered vessel. Also, what about the number suffering from leukemia? That is the most likely form of cancer to balloon if there was a serious contamination. When the subject of why there has not been a similar explosion of cases on the mainland, fearmongers say it's a conspiracy of silence. Really? Last I could find is that this case has actually been thrown out of court. Well, there is no doubt that this was a major accident, with only one comparable precedent, Chernobyl. So let's compare. Both were the highest level incidents on the International Nuclear Event Scale, a 7, leading actually to recent talk that the scale may need to be refined. Each plant was constructed around the same time, Chernobyl in 1977 and Fukushima in 71. Fukushima produced about 20% more power than Chernobyl's 4 gigawatts. Fukushima was a larger plant, it had 6 reactors compared to Chernobyl's 4, and a bigger accident, as in that only one reactor, Chernobyl, was involved, whereas 4 reactors were involved plus a cooling pond at Fukushima. Fukushima even had 10 times more fuel in their reactors. So you might think Fukushima deserves the hype. That's true until you realize these were very different kinds of accidents. In Chernobyl, you had the reactor actually explode. Not only the reactor, but the containment building itself was destroyed, and there was no actually containment vessel like you did have with Fukushima. So you had parts of the innards spewing outside the plant. That's sort of what we would call a dirty bomb now. Fukushima, on the other hand, had a contained meltdown. None of the core escaped the building. In fact, relative to the globe, the only source of radiation was carried away by water used to cool the reactors. Don't get me wrong, this aquatic waste is an ongoing issue and has great potential for risk for locals. But let's look at the actual damage done by each. The peak radiation, direct radiation from the reactors, is as little as 7,000 millivolts compared to 300,000 millivolts for Chernobyl. The amount released into the atmosphere has Fukushima at 900 petabecquerels compared to 5,200 for Chernobyl. That said, there is still a risk of minor leaks that could eventually raise this number. Total radiation release from Fukushima has been calculated to be about 370,000 terabecquerels compared to 5.2 million for Chernobyl. And it should be noted that the total amount leaked into the Pacific since the original event has only been about 7.2 terabecquerels, which sounds like a lot, but compared to the volume of the ocean, literally a drop in the bucket. Deaths. We as to date, there's been no links to radiation and deaths at Fukushima. Now, cancers do take a long time to sometimes manifest, so this story is open on this one. But the WHO stated that those at high risk, female infants to thyroid cancer, only have an increased risk of 0.5%. For leukemia, an increase of only 0.35%. The total direct deaths from Chernobyl are about 31, and those are people who died within a month or so of the incident. The UN puts the total deaths from radiation as of 2008 at 64. Some groups claim a much higher number, anywhere from a couple of hundred to a few thousand. These have not been substantiated. In fact, in my research, the greatest by order of magnitude health effect was not cancer and was not caused by Chernobyl at all. In fact, it was the psychological fear of getting cancer. Rates of depression, suicide, and alcoholism skyrocketed in the region. In fact, these fearmongers are playing into that very same psychological Russian roulette, no pun intended. So far, there has been one kind of death from Fukushima. I say kind of death because it is from a cancer, but it didn't occur until 2 years later, compared to the 29 who died a month after Chernobyl. And people do get cancers naturally. That said, he was one of the 50 volunteers who stayed at the plant when all the others were evacuated. Of course, none of the other 50s have shown signs of overexposure. Now, I don't want to sound like I'm underplaying the damage done. It is likely that others, tens or more, will die eventually from cancer, and it cannot be ruled out that Fukushima did not play a role in that. That said, Fukushima, although bad, was not an apocalypse. There were few, if any, lives lost. Relative to the tsunami and earthquake, nothing was lost. Over almost 20,000 people died in those events. The area was contaminated, but it was only slight contamination, at least on land. I think the jury may still be out on the waters close to the plant. And that is an issue only because a private corporation was put in charge of the cleanup effort. And time seems to have shown that's a bad idea. What might have been a dirty but quick cleanup, like Chernobyl, has become a festering sore of low-level sporadic leakage. Because of the hype and the press about this incident, Japan, Germany, and other nations have shut down their nuclear power plants. They are now reliant on fossil fuels because the, quote, risk of life from an event like Fukushima is too great. Really? I've already stated that the loss of life, worst case scientifically based scenario, is many a couple of hundreds, maybe. And that's if things go very wrong. Okay, I'll give you maybe even 1,000, right? There are some debates about how many people actually died in the Chernobyl event. And I agree, it's not chump change. But let's even make the anti-nuke argument even stronger. A number of fearmongers, like the article I stated in this segment before, people are likely to have claimed that Chernobyl is responsible for 100,000 deaths. Well, let's increase that by an order of magnitude, and let's double it to include Fukushima. So over the past 30 years, it's possible that 2 million people have died prematurely thanks to nuclear power. That's a feck of a lot of people. But compared to what? Japan and Germany have, at least in the short term, switched from nuclear to coal and oil power generation. This means there's more air pollution, groundwater contamination, and just general ickiness in the atmosphere. And unlike nuclear, it's not the locals involved, but the entire planet, or at least larger regions, that can be affected by this pollution. Studies show that anywhere from 50 to 100,000 people a year die from air pollution associated with coal-burning plants. An even stronger claim is made that almost 2 million air pollution deaths were prevented globally over the last 40 years because of the use of nuclear power over air-polluting fossil fuel. If you add those two numbers up, and we're not even including natural gas or other things, that's over 6 million deaths. Compared to the actual effects of Fukushima and Chernobyl, it's definitely a win situation to go with nuclear. Even if we ignore, though, the secondary effects, such as death from lung cancer or other related ailments. If we just stick with sort of direct deaths, it's estimated that 2,500 workers in the oil and gas industry alone, and only in the U.S., have died on the job. And this is not including secondary deaths, i.e. from sort of chronic poisoning from chemical exposure. That amounts to, in the U.S. alone, over the same sort of 30-year period, almost 100,000 deaths. And if you consider the U.S. population is only about 4.45% of the world's population, you get almost 2.5 million people dying directly from oil and gas injuries. In fact, when broken down to deaths per terawatt hour, the safest form of power is nuclear at 0.04 deaths per terawatt hour. Compare that to hydro, which is 1.4, natural gas at 4, biomass at 12, oil at 36, and coming out as the most dangerous source of energy on the planet, excluding asteroidal impact, is coal at a whopping 161 deaths per terawatt hour. So nuclear may be controversial, but it's largely sound and fury and not substance. Personally, I would remove the subsidies for fossil fuel industry. I would suppress NIMBYism vis-a-vis nuclear power. I would tax carbon like I would tobacco and plow as much of it as I can into green, environmentally friendly, yes, I'm looking at you biofuels, evil, friendly energy sources. But until green has matured, investing in fourth gen and fifth gen nuclear reactors, into thorium-based reactors, a long-term solution to much of our energy needs, especially with regards to space exploration, where earthbound power sources like wind and solar are not viable. One last note, science will always find a way. It has been rumored that there are plans to purposely allow a nuclear meltdown to study what actually happens when such event occurs. You would think they would have done this already, but it seems to be a very understudied event. Of course, this is to be done in a lab and only with one fuel rod, but the events of Fukushima Daiichi has inspired us to strive to know more. When science is shown to be lacking, it attempts to self-correct by understanding where it went wrong and correcting itself to create a better and more accurate future. Go Team Science! And now for some skeptic highlights. Coming up next Tuesday, January 21st, is Skeptics in the Pub. That's downtown at the Railway Club. Come on down and socialize and mix with some of your favorite or unknown local skeptics. Also coming up is January's Cafe Scientific, Fluvial Tili, Pisces Diversitae. This is a look at the diversity of freshwater fishes, an underappreciated and under threat entity. The term fish diversity immediately conjures up images of strikingly colored fishes on coral reefs, but over 40% of more than 33,000 fish species occur in freshwater, which comprise only 0.8% of the Earth's surface. Freshwater fishes are therefore the most diverse group of vertebrates per unit area on Earth. Furthermore, recent research suggests that the rate of the origin of new biodiversity is greater in freshwater than in the marine realm. Within this context, a presentation is going to be presented on the patterns of biodiversity in British Columbia freshwater fish, its nature and its origins, and exploring the few examples of evolutionary marvels of our freshwater fishes. So come on down to the Cafe Scientific that's going to be held at the Railway Club January 28th. Another event, Sexism, Capitalism, and the Fight for Liberation. How did sexism originate? What's its role in our society? And why is it so hard to eradicate? Join the International Socialist as they talk about sexism in a modern capitalist society. Another interesting event. The revolution will not be circumcised. Circumcised? Yes, I said circumcised. And on national radio, no less. Now, to be fair, I'm only presenting this as a courtesy to UBC Freethinkers. I personally don't support this. But from the advertising blurb, the revolution will not be circumcised. An X-rated sex ed comedy horror show, curator-performer Glenn Callender describes a puppetry of the penis meets an inconvenient truth, examines foreskin and circumcision in a way that has never been attempted on stage. Quote, my foreskin and I reveal fascinating foreskin phenomena that are virtually unknown. Intact men will come away with a new appreciation for the foreskin, while circumcised men will gain a new understanding of what they have lost. Foreskin is not extra skin. It is the most sensitive and pleasurable part of the penis, and we can all prove it. Side note, it's also the leading source for HIV infection as well. Anyhow, continuing. So check out this foreskin propaganda that's going to be put on this Friday, January 17th, 5 p.m. at 1866 Main Mall, if you want. I won't be there. And of course, the highlight of the skeptic calendar for this month, anyhow, is Darwin Day Weekend Skeptics at the Pub, Saturday, January 15th, 7 p.m. Also held at the skeptic's most favorite pub in town, Railway Club. Show up and discuss Darwin, his effects on the world, and notably, it's Alfred Russel Wallace's 100th anniversary death, if deaths are an anniversary. So it's probably a cool event. I might show up. You might show up. Anyway, I think we've reached the end of the show. And we're going to end with a couple of clips from an online course called Crash Course. It's going to teach us all about nuclear chemistry and nuclear fission and fusion. So learn a little something. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
Apparently, it can turn you into a superhero or into a mutant zombie. It's the plot device for probably half of the sci-fi movies made in the last 60 years, and it's even the name of the song that welcomes you to the new age. To the new age, welcome to the new age. Presumably this new age occurring after some kind of apocalypse. As principles of chemistry go, few figure more prominently in the popular imagination than radioactivity, but at the same time, few are as completely misunderstood. Most people think of radioactivity as just something that mutates genes and melts faces off. And yes, some forms of radioactivity can do those things. But all the more reason to understand it, right? And also, we can harness it to produce lots of electricity to fuel our rock and roll lifestyles without contributing to global warming, though, as Fukushima has taught us, it comes with some of its own problems, which we'll explore more next episode. Before we get into the nuts and bolts of nuclear chemistry, like nuclear fission and why it's so awesome, as well as fusion and why it's so hard to do, we'll first get to know radioactivity. What it is, what different kinds there are, and why you don't really need to fear it. At least, you know, not all the time. So, radioactivity doesn't actually have a lot to do with chemistry in the sense that we've been talking about for most of this course. Chemical reactions happen when an atom's outermost electrons do stuff, and the protons and neutrons and even the inner electron shells are usually completely unaffected. But the protons and neutrons are still part of the atom, of course, still part of the chemicals, and their interactions are important. When protons and neutrons get directly involved in reactions and their numbers do change, huge amounts of energy can be released, far more than by the transfer of electrons that we've learned about in other reactions. When these changes happen to the nucleus of an atom, we rather logically call their study nuclear chemistry. Now, it's probably occurred to you already that changing the nucleus of an atom can completely change its nature. Protons are the key to an atom's identity, so any change that affects the number of protons will turn one element into a completely different one. An alchemist's dream, right? Lead to gold. So, as you might expect, that's not something that usually happens in a typical chemical reaction. The same can be said of that other component of the nucleus, neutrons. Atoms of the same element that have the same number of protons, but different numbers of neutrons are isotopes. So changes in the number of neutrons in an atom create different isotopes of the same element. Both of these kinds of changes, changing one element to another or changing one isotope to another, are known as transmutation. And it is indeed possible to transmute lead to gold. It's just so ridiculously expensive that the tiny amounts of gold produced could never pay for the process. But the very fact that it is possible should clue you in that nuclear chemistry is an entirely different flavor of chemistry sauce. Though, as with non-nuclear chemistry, the changes that take place in a nuclear reaction all come down to the atom's desire to have what we all want in life, stability. Just as atoms are most stable when their outermost electron orbitals are full of electrons, certain combinations of protons and neutrons make the nucleus more stable. And just like when an atom gains or loses or shares electrons to stabilize its outer shell, when the numbers of protons and neutrons aren't ideal, the nucleus releases some of them to try to reach a stable configuration. When a nucleus decomposes in this way to form a different nucleus, that's radioactive decay. And just like with other chemical reactions we've talked about, we need to know more about a nuclear reaction than just what's reacting and what's being produced. Probably the most important thing to learn is how much of the product is being made and how fast. Now, you've heard of half-life. It's the measurement that tells us just that. The time it takes for exactly one half of the sample to decay. Different nuclei have different half-lives. By knowing the half-life, we can calculate how much of a sample will be gone in a given amount of time. For example, the half-life of phosphorus-32 is 14.3 days. So if you start with a 100-gram sample, after about 2 weeks, you'll have 50 grams left. After another 2 weeks, half of the remainder would decay, leaving only 25 grams of undecayed phosphorus, and so on. Now, you might be asking, if radioactive elements are always decaying into more and more stable isotopes that are eventually no longer radioactive, why are they still around at all? Fascinating question. You seem to have brought your clever pants today. Well, it's fairly simple. Given enough time, all radioactive elements would decay into non-radioactive forms. Even ultra-stable bismuth with its half-life longer than the age of the universe. But elements with short half-lives are around because they were decayed into by elements that recently decayed into them. The chain of decay from the element originally produced in whatever supernova created them to the elements that exist on Earth now lasts billions and billions of years. Also, I should note that some radioactive isotopes like carbon-14 in the atmosphere are constantly being renewed by cosmic rays. Now, radioactive decay occurs when a nucleus has a higher energy level than a potentially more stable version. Typically, this difference in energy is released as what's called ionizing radiation, which you know as radioactivity. It's ionizing because it has enough energy to knock electrons out or add electrons to other atoms, essentially creating ions. There are three general types of radioactive decay, each named for exactly what is released from the nucleus as it decays. Let's take a look at what may be the most famous radioactive element, uranium. By far the most common naturally occurring form of uranium is the isotope uranium-238. More than 99% of the natural uranium in the world is in this form. U-238 spontaneously decays into thorium-234 in a process that releases something called an alpha particle. This is called alpha decay, and the particle that it emits is basically the same as a helium nucleus, two protons and two neutrons. We even describe it that way when writing it. So right away, you can see that the math checks out when it comes to the protons and neutrons. 92 minus 2 is 90, and 238 minus 4 leaves you with 234. But you'll note that we don't write the charges. The helium nucleus obviously has a plus 2 charge, and the thorium atom would have a negative charge as well. While it's not incorrect to write them, these charges are often emitted to emphasize what's going on in the nucleus. Now, alpha particles have relatively low energy. They're pretty heavy as particles go. So while I try not to make a habit of walking around with a hunk of uranium in my pocket, alpha particles can be stopped by nothing more than a sheet of paper or cloth. The second type of radioactive decay is beta decay, which simply emits electrons. It has somewhat higher energy than alpha radiation, but it can still be stopped by a sheet of aluminum foil or even the top layers of your skin. So that thorium-234 that formed when uranium underwent alpha decay, it can continue to decay on its own, and when it does, it undergoes beta decay, releasing an electron and an atom of xenon. Notice that, again, the way we write this is a little different. Even though the thorium emits an electron, we don't use the usual symbol for electrons. Instead, we write it in nuclear notation form, with the mass number at the top and the atomic number at the bottom. Since it's an electron and not a proton, we put a -1 for the atomic number. That probably seems a little bit weird right now, but next week when we talk about nuclear equations, you will see why it is useful. The third type of decay is a little different because it only emits energy, not a particle. It's called gamma decay, and it releases electromagnetic radiation similar to visible light or UV radiation, but higher on the energy scale. Because it's just energy, gamma radiation has no mass and contains no protons, neutrons, or electrons, so it's written with two zeros. This form of radiation is often released when electrons transition from an unstable, excited state to a more stable state that has a lower energy. That's called the ground state. Depending on how much energy the electron loses, the extra energy can be released in the form of visible or ultraviolet light, X-rays, or gamma waves. Let's take the example of nickel-60. Imagine there's an atom of nickel-60 with one or more of its electrons in an excited state. That's what the little asterisk designates. Atoms can get to this state when they are themselves the products of radioactive decay, or if they get bombarded with radiation from other reactions pushing their electrons into a higher energy level. Now, when all those electrons drop down to the ground state, that atom is gonna release some gamma radiation. But this kind of transition can also take place where other kinds of nuclear reactions are going on, so gamma decay often occurs along with some other form of decay too. So, for example, if that uranium atom is in an excited state when it decays into thorium, it can simultaneously release gamma waves, as well as the alpha particle I already mentioned. Now, you might have heard of gamma radiation more than the other kinds I've mentioned, because it can actually do some serious harm, like potentially turning you into a giant green rage monster that doesn't obey the laws of conservation of matter. Unlike the particles emitted by other kinds of radiation, gamma rays can penetrate your skin, your cell membranes, and ultimately the organelles within your cells. So gamma radiation can not only cause skin burns, nausea, other symptoms we associate with radiation poisoning, it can also alter your DNA, causing mutations and cancer. Okay, but to turn the frown upside down, there's one more type of radioactivity that I'm happy to say is really simple. It's called spontaneous fission, and it occurs when an atom simply breaks into two smaller atoms without any outside help. This occurs at a ridiculously slow rate in most cases. In fact, the only substance that does it at a rate that's sufficient to serve any purpose is californium-254, and that purpose is to produce neutrons for use in other nuclear reactions. But we'll talk more about that when we go into fission, fusion, and how scientists use and control nuclear reactions. In the meantime, thank you for watching this episode of Crash Course Chemistry. If you listened carefully, you learned what radioactivity really is and about transmutation among elements and among isotopes, and how to make calculations based on an element's half-life. You also learned about different types of radioactive decay, alpha, beta, and gamma, and about spontaneous fission. As I said before, chemistry is, like many aspects of your own life, all about a search for stability. Last week we talked about radioactive decay and how atomic nuclei get rid of various particles in order to become more stable. But what is this elusive stability that all things seem to be striving for exactly? In nuclear chemistry, it simply has to do with keeping the nucleus together. If the nucleus is going to break apart, then that's not going to be something that lasts very long. Stability really is kind of just a way of saying it can exist. And the amount of energy that holds each proton or neutron in an atom's nucleus is the same amount that's released when it's removed. This is known as binding energy, and it's one of the fundamental principles of nuclear chemistry. It's actually what we mean when we talk about nuclear energy. Now, I'm not gonna lie to you, nuclear chemistry is terribly complicated, but we have a way of understanding it that, while not exactly simple, is one that I'm sure you've heard of. The binding energy of an atom is calculated with a formula, E equals mc squared. Probably the most famous equation in the world, and since it was first hit upon by a young patent clerk in 1905, it has become synonymous with scientific genius. Part of why it's so famous, I like to think, is because the logic behind it is so elegantly simple and yet totally counterintuitive. But it's probably also famous because it's important. It explains one of the most powerful sources of energy known to humanity. E equals mc squared is formally known as the mass-energy equivalence formula, and it states that mass is interchangeable with energy. Okay, there's a lot there in what I just said. To tease it apart, consider the nucleus of an atom of oxygen, 8 protons and 8 neutrons. Collectively, by the way, these particles are known as nucleons. If you were to add up all the individual masses of all 16 nucleons separately, and then compare that to the total mass of an actual oxygen nucleus, you'd find that there's a difference between the two. Specifically, the mass of the nucleus, exactly 15.99 atomic mass units, is lower than the mass of its individual nucleons put together. In this case, 16.13 AMUs. That mass went somewhere. That missing mass in the nucleus, known as its mass defect, is actually present in the form of energy. It's the energy that holds the nucleons together. So, for example, the mass defect for an oxygen atom is negative 2.269 times 10 to the negative 28th kilograms. To find out how much binding energy that missing mass amounts to, you can use it as the M in Einstein's formula. This ingenious little equation relates mass and energy by a simple proportionality constant, and thanks to Einstein, we know that constant is the square of the speed of of light, or C squared. Solve for E, and you find that the binding energy in that oxygen nucleus is 2.04 times 10 to the negative 11th joules, with the negative sign indicating that the energy is being released. Now, of course, 2.04 times 10 to the negative 11th is a very small number. That might surprise you, but hold the phone. That is just for one single nucleus. If we multiply that by Avogadro's number to find the energy change for a whole mole of oxygen nuclei, a mere 16 grams of oxygen, we get an amazing 1.23 times 10 to the 13th joules of energy. To produce that energy with coal, you would have to burn 420,000 kilograms, 420 metric tons of coal. That energy is what we mean when we talk about nuclear energy, the binding energy that's released when a nucleon is removed from its nucleus. Now, to dislodge one of those nucleons and unleash that energy, there are two general types of nuclear reactions: fission and fusion. Fission occurs when a large nucleus splits into two lighter ones. Fusion is the opposite, when two light nuclei join together to form a heavier one. In both cases, the products of the reaction are more stable than the starting materials, and this is, as always, what drives the reaction. This is a graph of the binding energies of various elements compared to their mass numbers. Elements with very high binding energies, such as iron 56, are very stable and rarely undergo nuclear reactions, but elements with lower binding energies can react much more readily. If the nucleus is heavier than iron 56, it will tend to break into two or more smaller nuclei, a fission reaction. If it's lighter than iron 56, it will more likely participate in a fusion reaction, joining two nuclei together to form a heavier one. But the most important thing to notice here is that with both fission and fusion, stability increases as a result of the reaction. Fission is the type of reaction that we use more often because it's the one that we're better at initiating and controlling, at least so far. And whether it's used in power plants or bombs, the most common fuel for fission is uranium-235. There are several ways that it can react, but the reaction is almost always triggered by hitting uranium with neutrons from another source. When that happens, the uranium splits into smaller atoms. One such reaction produces krypton-92. Yes, krypton is a real thing, along with barium-141. Three free neutrons and lots of energy. This energy is released mainly as the kinetic energy of the escaping particles, which is immediately transferred to the surroundings as heat. Some energy is also released in the form of electromagnetic radiation, such as visible light, X-rays, and gamma radiation. Nuclear power plants use the energy released by these reactions to convert water to steam, which then is passed through turbines, spinning a generator, powering cities and stuff. Because of the enormous amounts of energy these reactions can release, nuclear power plants can potentially produce lots of electricity. But there's also, I think you may have heard, some serious drawbacks. For one thing, as you know, atoms rarely exist in isolation. We write the equation of a fission reaction as if it's just one atom, but in reality, that one atom is surrounded by many, many more. And if one little neutron can trigger the reaction, and that reaction liberates three more neutrons, well, I think you can see where this is going. If the reaction isn't controlled, each reaction triggers three more, and every reaction releases the same amount of energy, which adds up fast. This is pretty much the definition of a chain reaction, and it is the basis of the remarkable power of a nuclear weapon. The same type of reaction occurs in nuclear power plants, but those reactions are controlled in several ways to keep them from getting out of hand. The fact is, these chain reactions have the potential to produce far more heat than the plant can use, so much more that the temperature can easily rise to dangerous levels, enough to melt the uranium. This is the meltdown that you hear about, and most reactor cores are immersed in water to disperse the heat and prevent this from happening. But that's not enough on its own to control this thing. If the chain reaction is allowed to run freely, no amount of water can remove the heat fast enough to prevent a meltdown. The real way we control nuclear reactions is with control rods. They're made of materials that readily absorb neutrons, and they're inserted between the fuel rods of uranium to slow the neutrons down and therefore slow down the reaction. They can be put in more to slow the reaction more and lift it out more if you need more heat. Now, the other sticky wicket of fission reactions is the stuff that's left behind. These reactions not only produce products that are still radioactive, they produce tons of them. Lots of different troublesome kinds. Like we saw last week, uranium undergoes many different types of nuclear decay, so not only does each uranium atom produce isotopes of krypton and bromine, but that process also produces many other isotopes of other elements. And as these various nuclei break down, they release more neutrons and more unstable products, and the process continues for a long time. All of these reactions eventually yield stable products, but they have half-lives ranging from a few years to tens of millions of years. The problem Electronics with shorter half-lives stabilize pretty quickly, but they release particles and energy like crazy during that time, so they're extra dangerous. The ones with longer half-lives decay more slowly, release less energy, but that means it takes a very, very long time for them to stabilize. So long, in fact, that for human purposes it may as well be forever. That means they'll always be an issue in our environment, which is why we're always looking for ways to store them and keep them out of our way. Fusion reactions, as you'd expect, are very different from fission. For one thing, the energy released in many fusion reactions dwarfs even the huge amount released by fission. You might be familiar, for example, with the wonderful work done by our sun. The reactions that power the sun are like most fusion reactions in that they involve very small nuclei, like isotopes of hydrogen and helium. This reaction begins when two atoms of hydrogen, accelerated by the sun's fantastically high temperatures and contained by its high pressures, join to form an atom of deuterium, an isotope of hydrogen. This fusion of particles releases a positron and some heat energy in the process. Then another atom of hydrogen is joined to the deuterium to form helium-3. This step also releases a lot of energy in the form of gamma radiation. When two atoms of helium-3 are available, they join together to form an atom of helium-4, as well as two atoms of regular hydrogen, which then can be used to begin the process all over again. This final step also, as you might imagine, releases a large amount of energy in the form of mostly gamma radiation. So this is a chain reaction too, but it's not a self-perpetuating one like we saw before. This reaction requires a total input of 6 atoms of hydrogen, but it only produces 2 in the end, the remaining mass being released in the form of helium. For this reason, more fuel is always needed, which is why our sun is gonna run out of hydrogen in about 5.5 billion years. We can produce fusion reactions here on Earth too, but they're not very useful for us because we haven't figured out how to control them. They're super useful if you just want to blow up a big city, though. Just to be clear. Depending on your definition of use. One reason is, as you can see in the mass energy graph, light nuclei that fuse together undergo a much larger energy change than heavy nuclei that break apart. That means their reactions release far more energy than fission reactions do, so much more that it's nearly impossible to contain and therefore use. Also, because fusion involves joining nuclei, the reaction has to overcome the really strong repulsion that naturally exists between their positive charges. For this reason, fusion reactions can only occur when particles collide at very high speeds or under very high pressures. At these mind-blowing speeds, the kinetic energy of the particles produces insane temperatures, like in the 100 million Kelvin range, at which point the material being accelerated actually exists in the form of plasma. So not only are those speeds really hard to reach, but material at that temperature, how do you control that? Which is why we can't use fusion for things like generating electricity, which would be super nice. We've only found applications for it when we don't need to control it at all, like in nuclear weapons. So as you can tell, there is plenty of room for new ideas in nuclear chemistry. Fusion would be really great because it would produce a lot of energy and you'd just get helium out of the process, and helium is awesome. How can we use radioactive materials more efficiently? Is there a way to achieve the speeds and manage temperatures that come with fusion? And how can we do this stuff without blowing our faces off? You've already taken the first step by learning the basics. It's up to you how far you want to go from here. Maybe you'll write the next totally crazy, ingenious, and counterintuitive equation that takes us to the next level. For now, though, thank you for watching this episode of Crash Course Chemistry. If you paid attention, you learned how Einstein's famous formula helps us calculate the binding energy of a nucleus from its mass defect. You also learned the difference between fission and fusion. You saw an example of each one, and you learned about their applications in the real world.
To make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of it.
and I sweat my rust. I'm breathing in the chemicals. I'm breaking in, shaping up, then checking out on the prison bus. This is it, the apocalypse. Whoa.
Inside.